I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, December 6th. We'll get a take now on how we got to this point on abortion rights, where the Supreme Court does actually seem likely to overturn Roe versus Wade in the coming months, despite it being precedent for nearly 50 years. Spoiler alert, Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine doesn't just blame the right, but also in large measure the liberal establishment, which failed to prioritize or protect it enough, including Democrats named Bernie, Hillary, and Barack. Rebecca Traister is New York Magazine staff writer and author of the influential books Good and Mad, All the Single Ladies, and Big Girls Don't Cry. I'll also ask for her reaction to the firing of Chris Cuomo by CNN over the weekend. Rebecca, always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's always good to be here, Brian.
Want to start with Chris Cuomo, since it just happened? Another high-profile man willing to deprioritize women's safety and respect while saying he prioritized and respected them?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't reported on Chris Cuomo. I'm reading the stories about him, as you and many listeners are. One of the things that has struck me about the Chris Cuomo story is the absolute speed and readiness with which his suspension, and was framed as, well, he put family above his job because he was advising his brother, and that has just made me so, furious and just sort of sick to my stomach. The notion, especially in the context of this period where you have so many people out there actually juggling their professional responsibilities and their family responsibilities, and the idea that he made unethical choices as a journalist to try to work to cover up his powerful brother's misdeeds and power abuses.
Yeah. And maybe the most poignant line, if poignant is the right word, from Chris Cuomo's own mouth was after Andrew Cuomo resigned. Cuomo defended himself regarding his own role on the August 16th episode of his show. This was quoted in the Times coverage of his firing over the weekend, when he said, "I never attacked nor encouraged anyone to attack any woman who came forward. I never made calls to the press about my brother's situation," unquote. But the new batch of testimony and text messages that were released by Attorney General Letitia James suggested that Chris Cuomo did function as an advisor and did reach out to journalists. He told the investigators, when asked, "I would reach out to sources, other journalists, to see if they had heard of anyone else coming out." So before we move on from this to Roe, how much is that a bright line for you, Rebecca, aiding in the discrediting of women coming forward to report harassment?
Well, it's an extremely bright line, but it's a bright line in so many directions. He also lied, right? What you just, the statement that you just read, right, versus the reality is that he lied. And I think it's really important to note that lying is also a huge part of the story of Andrew Cuomo. And this notion that you can lie and cover up and not abide by the rules, he clearly understood what the rules were. And, he says so in his denial. "I never did this wrong thing." When you have a degree of power to shape the news, to shape the story, to shape how millions of viewers are understanding what's happening in terms of politics and pandemic around issues of harassment and power abuse, be they sexual or otherwise, and you're operating to protect, whether it's your brother or not, but you're fundamentally operating to protect the powerful and then lying to cover it up. These things are all just symptomatic of how powerful people remain powerful and twist and pervert the work that they're doing in order to protect their own authority.
All right. Roe versus Wade and the direct challenge to it that the Supreme Court heard last week. You put the possible failure to protect Roe in a larger context in your New York Magazine article, a failure to protect against a regressive movement's project to ensure minority rule. And I wonder if you'd go into that a little bit first. What's the largest possible context for this that you're thinking about?
Well, when I think about how the Democratic Party has operated and failed to protect, to vociferously and muscularly protect the victories made in the middle of mostly in the middle of the 20th century, some beyond, around civil rights, reproductive rights, voting rights, that those victories, which were achieved sort of as the pinnacle of grassroots often centuries-long movements of organizers coming from the margins of power, working together to push for, and suffering decades, generations of violence and setbacks, right? And many of those movements that had been at work over centuries found their success within our political and legal system in the middle of the 20th century. So that means the legalization of birth control, which we forget was not that far in front of the legalization of abortion, the protection of voting rights and civil rights. And then once those things were won within the courts and federally, legislatively in some cases, what we found was a Democratic Party that wasn't, in my view, willing to understand that those things, just because they'd won, didn't mean that it was over. And the way that the right has done it we can talk about that, moving through states, moving through state legislatures, school mm-hmm. boards, right. Co-opting language, using that kind of muscular co-optation of language and frameworks around morality, family, life. And Democrats, my parties, I am very open You're about out. My political leanings. Mm-hmm. My party has failed to treat this with moral urgency in terms of how it has spoken about these rights, been willing to defend them, and how it's failed to strategize.
Let me take an example that you cite in the article. And it's this moment from the last televised debate in the 2016 Trump-Clinton election. Listeners, I'm going to subject you to just a few seconds of this short clip here that starts with moderator Chris Wallace from Fox.
Do you want to see the court overturn Roe v.
Well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that's really what's going to be, that will happen. And that'll happen automatically, in my opinion, because I am putting pro-life justices on the court.
So that was really a campaign promise, and it was so explicit. And Rebecca, looking at the Supreme Court appointments by Trump, and he said two, possibly three, that was 2016. Well, he got his three, as we know, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Coney Barrett. And you write that after that, the Democrats chose not to vocally fight, or when the nomination processes were going on, the confirmation processes, that the Democrats chose not to vocally fight those nominations as an assault on Roe. But make that case, because the public perception might be that whenever a Republican nominates a justice, Roe is the first thing the Democrats talk about, and maybe as such it's the primary Supreme Court issue at stake that most people could even name.
Well, I disagree. I have not seen the party make the absolute case that Roe is going to fall, not as an organizing principle against these candidates. Yes, it is something that people talk about, but Democrats haven't made a morally compelling argument. First of all, I want to back up a little bit to before Roe, because in fact, one of the things Democrats have failed to do is fight for abortion accessibility beyond Roe, because Democrats ceded the ability to access safe and affordable abortions for poor Americans way back in the 70s when the Hyde Amendment passed, right? And so abortion has become all but inaccessible to millions of people, women and people who can get pregnant across America over decades. And it is true that when you have a Supreme Court nominee, there is some press coverage about Roe specifically, but what there is not is coordinated, penetrating argument and questioning about the record. There is a kind of acceptance, this pantomime of, in Brett Kavanaugh's case, and this comes not from the left, but from Susan Collins, but a Republican who always said she would fight for continued abortion access. Mm-hmm. But does not, the belief, the sort of acceptance of, he says he's going to stand by decided law, Roe is decided law, and then everybody sort of says, okay, that's great, after the hearing of Amy Coney Barrett, a justice who everybody knew had anti-abortion stances, there was this sort of, the Dianne Feinstein, statement that, this went as well as any confirmation hearing I can hear. There's no active fighting, first of all, about the fact that many of these seats were ill-gotten, you know, during the Trump administration, you know, the failure to of Republicans to even hear Merrick Garland and allow disallow President Barack Obama, a Supreme Court appointment, the sort of rushing through of Amy Coney Barrett's appointment at absolute odds with what happened around Merrick Garland. And I have not felt that Democrats muscularly fight individually. Individually, there are certainly Democrats who have made compelling arguments, but I have not seen strategizing coming from a Democratic caucus saying we are going to make abundantly clear to the American people what it means to not have abortion access, to have abortion become illegal. What are the stakes? It's not, you know, what can happen moving forward? What has already happened? Who has already not permitted, because of the erosion of abortion rights around the country, to not access this safe, legal, and medically necessary procedure?
You mentioned Susan Collins. I want to play a clip of hers that after this coming Supreme Court decision may or may not come back to haunt her. I guess it probably won't affect her, at least not for a long time, because as a six-year term senator, she's not up for re-election for quite a few years yet. But this is what she said in defending her being a nominally pro-choice Republican senator and her support for Brett Kavanaugh when his nomination was taking place. Listen.
In his testimony, he noted repeatedly that Roe had been upheld by Planned Parenthood versus Casey, describing it as precedent on precedent. When I asked him, would it be sufficient to overturn a long-established precedent if five current justices believed that it was wrongly decided, he emphatically said, no.
Emphatically said no. But Rebecca, I wonder if the loophole there is that she said if five current justices, now it looks like they have six.
Right. But it's not even a loophole. She was not telling the truth. This is what I mean when I say pantomime. And again, you know, that Susan Collins is a Republican, though nominally a pro-choice one. But it is also true when Dianne Feinstein congratulates everybody on the wonderful, you know, confirmation proceedings. Nobody has been telling the truth. And I mean that, you know, sort of across two parties. And I don't mean to say nobody, because, again, obviously there have been individuals who have been fighting hard over decades. But as a party and institutionally, Democrats have not done a good job about saying this. Look, this is what's going to happen. This is who these people are. There's not even, and it goes back even to the willingness to say what Mitch McConnell was doing when he refused to permit President Barack Obama to fill that seat was a takeover, was a perverse, a breaking of the system to ensure minority rule. And it did, because Donald Trump, remember that Donald Trump is a person, is a president who won fewer votes than his opponent and had got to confirm three justices to the United States, to the United States Supreme Court, that other members of the Supreme Court, including some that he appointed, were on the legal team that helped to win George Bush the presidency in 2000 when he won fewer votes than his opponent and yet became the president. We are living in a period in which a minority president selected by a minority of voters have taken over the Supreme Court and are going to reverse all those victories that were won in the middle of the 20th century. And those stakes and that manipulation of the system, I have not heard made clear enough to the American people and to voters, including by the leadership of the party that I support, the Democrats.
And not only that, statistically about minority rule, you cite as a Republican fiction the idea that the country is deeply divided on this issue at all, when abortion rights is one of the most popular planks, you write, for the Democratic Party, even in red states. So I thought, is that true? And I looked up a Pew survey from this year that found 59% supported abortion rights in most or all cases, to just 39%, opposed. But we see all these restrictions at the state level, mostly in red states. So how would that happen in those red states if they're not popular there?
Well, but this is what, consider what happens all the time. Many of the most popular issues in this country, and by the way, they're ones that are tied to abortion rights. They are the kinds of protections. We just had this big fight over Build Back Better around paid leave and subsidized childcare. Some of those are the most popular positions, even including in red states. And yet, and this is, again, a complaint about the Democratic Party won't make the moral and muscular case and won't show the way that all of these things are connected, that in fact, building better economic policies along with protections, especially for vulnerable Americans, for people of color, for poor people, for young people, for people in rural communities, is going to make their lives better, their families stronger, right? And yet there is an unwillingness on the part of Democrats at a federal level to make that case. And the right wing has in fact taken over red state legislatures, gerrymandered the heck out of them, right? To the point where they can often maintain control, and a right wing doesn't want to put those kinds of economic and civil rights measures in place. They want to roll them back.
Here's a tweet from a listener who says, can you ask what exactly Democrats were supposed to do? The GOP doesn't care about people talking. What actual power to change these events did anyone have in the Democratic Party? Tweets a listener.
Well, there's actually Democrats could have operated more strategically on a state level over decades is one thing that they could do. B, I actually disagree that nobody cares about talking when we're talking about an entire framework. We are talking about a failure to make an energetic and muscular case for abortion, the protected right to access to reproductive health care and abortion as something that is key to familial thriving. The left ceded the language of life and morality and family to the right and to anti-abortion forces in a way that was totally unnecessary. And I actually do believe that talking matters when you're talking about how you frame an entire issue. Thirdly, Democrats have not been listening to the activists and the grassroots people, including leaders of the reproductive justice movement, who have been making vociferous, powerful cases for how all of these kinds of policy priorities are related, everything from, you know, increased and fighting against the gutting of social safety programs, against welfare and SNAP benefits, fighting right-wing fighting against affordable housing, how all of those things are linked to continuing to fight for voting rights and reproductive rights. And the Democratic Party hasn't taken cues from those on the ground activists who have been doing this work and talking about this over decades. The party is not taking that language and understanding how that fight can play out. And then there is the very practical failure to not take the state legislatures, the school boards seriously. This is how the right wing, the courts, you know, the right wing has been plotting the takeover of the courts over the decades since the courts decided, you know, against them in the mid-20th century. And Democrats did not take that fight seriously enough.
We have a few minutes left with Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine. Her new article is called The Betrayal of Roe. I want to end by asking you to look forward. I was reading an article in The Nation on how to protect abortion rights in the possible post-Roe world, and a lot of it was going beyond the necessary evil frame of characterizing abortion to a fuller embrace. It refers to protesters outside the Supreme Court during the hearing last week that had signs like, I had an abortion, and me and my homies heart abortion, and abortion positive, and as with some they were there from some of them were part of a group called Shout Your Abortion. I'm just curious if that's new and different to your eye and if you think that change of tactics can have more impact than, say, what the Clintons used to talk about, safe, legal, and rare.
Yeah, so I also heart abortion, and I do think it's absolutely crucial that we start to talk about abortion differently, acknowledging that abortion exists for millions of people in millions of different ways, but that it is I mean, abortion is not a necessary evil. Abortion is a cornerstone of reproductive health care. And abortion for those who need it or want it is liberation. Abortion is the ability to access abortion care when you or your family requires it. Provides a basis for people to have stronger, healthier, more economically stable, emotionally stable families of their shape and choosing. 60% of people who require abortion care are already parents. And that's something that we lose too often. And that doesn't, and to start to think about abortion that way, while also acknowledging that there are a million different ways to experience this procedure, right? And that lots of people, for reasons, you know, a personal belief or faith, feel very differently about it for themselves. And you know, to fight for continued access and legality and affordability isn't to force anyone who doesn't feel that way about abortion to have one. But the reverse is to force those who require it, need it, want it, and understand that it is key to full human thriving in this country and around the world, to force them either not to have them, or to have them in ways that are unsafe physically, and at this point, increasingly, as we look into the future, legally. And that is terrifying. The other thing that I think is crucial to know is that people will always have abortions. They have always had abortions. Making abortion illegal is not going to stop people from getting abortions or from ending pregnancy. And we have to start valuing the lives of the people who require abortion care, the individuals who may find themselves pregnant and need to end a pregnancy, but also the people who are their loved ones, their family, their friends. We have to start valuing those lives and that well-being as much and more as we value, as the right has forced the framework to somehow value the imagined character of the fetus.
Rebecca Traister is the author of the best-selling books Good and Mad and All the Single Ladies and the award-winning Big Girls Don't Cry, and her new article in New York Magazine, The Betrayal of Roe. Thanks as always, Rebecca.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.